Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Craig Joseph. He is a pediatrician. He's also board certified in clinical informatics, an old and dear friend of mine, and currently the chief medical officer at AVAP. Craig, thanks for joining me today.
It is my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So this is a news you can use, and you've been on my top list of folks to talk about current innovations in healthcare, in technology. I think you're extraordinarily well versed. And the purpose of this conversation is to bring people up to speed with what's going on in the healthcare space in both technology and innovation. So first off, let's talk about something that came up in the last several weeks. I think you were at the Epic UGM. And they made an announcement about Cosmos. So tell us what that is and why should we care?
Yeah, sure. So Epic is one of the biggest electronic health record companies and based in Wisconsin. And I was at their user group meeting last month, I think. And they had been talking about this idea of Cosmos being a way to take information from all of the hospitals and health systems and doctor's offices that are using their Epic electronic health record, and to make that, to de-identify that information so we can't pull it back and figure out who a specific patient is, but then to take some of those data points and see if you could make certain, essentially do research on that data. So instead of running a study to say, I wonder if high blood pressure causes more strokes. Now, that's something that we all know is true, but we know that's true because we've done studies in the future. So we'll take two groups of people, and one group will watch in a different way and see if there's a difference or if a different impact. So the idea is, if we take information from all of these healthcare systems, and Epic is, again, I think one of the largest in the country, if not certainly in the world. So take all of these major medical centers with just millions and millions, hundreds of millions of patients, really. And can we take their information? We know certain patients have diabetes. We know certain patients have hypertension. We can see their lab values. We can see some of what happens at their office visits. We know how much they weighed. If we can take that information and once it's de-identified, look at across years and years and do some analysis, that you might be able to kind of see correlations that would point you in the direction that something is there. So for instance, did folks who took medication A 20, 30 years later have a higher incidence of some disease?
But so you bring up a couple of points in there that I think are worth digging into just a little bit, because I like the idea. I mean, it's instant trials. It's instant sort of digging into data. It satisfies the curiosity of clinicians who want to understand some of this, and certainly the researchers. There are two questions that arise. One is, great, so you get a bunch of correlations. Does that get us any further down the track? And two, can you really de-anonymize that data, given that it only takes 9 separate elements to uniquely identify somebody, just based on a DEFCON presentation I saw?
Yeah, so I don't want to talk about either of those two things. So you've just definitely brought up the two really most difficult concepts with this idea. So again, let me say, Epic is not charging for this software. So this is just, I think, their attempt at saying, trying to have their customers leverage their data that bring value, right? So this is, again, not something that, let me just be clear that, I'm a customer of Epic. I don't speak for Epic, but
I understand.
Yeah, their concept is not that they would do the studies. The concept is that Epic's customers would pool their data, and they would create the infrastructure, and then Epic's customers would query it. So your first question was, does correlation equal causation? Of course it doesn't. I think the goal is not so much to to necessarily cure disease, instantly just by querying the electronic health record. But I think a lot of researchers, they wonder if there's there really is a correlation between this and that. Because if there's not, then if I can't show that, then there's no sense in trying to figure out why that correlation is there, right? Is there a causation? So I think this can short circuit that, the concept of is there correlation, and kind of go back to what I think now is one of the standards, although it's only happened a few years ago. In Flint, Michigan, a pediatrician had a suspicion that she was seeing more cases of lead poisoning or plumbism. And she wasn't sure, and she's only one pediatrician in Flint, Michigan, but she used a tool from the electronic health record to look across her patients and then further to look across all the patients that were in that health system in the same electronic health record. And she found proof of a correlation, right? She showed that it used to be that a small number of kids had lead poisoning, now a large, much larger number of kids. Now, did that tell her what the cause was? Absolutely not. But when she was able to say, this is not just a hunch, I have data now to prove that there's a big increase, we have to do something. I think that's the concept behind COSMO. So if someone has a hunch, maybe if they're at the Mayo Clinic or Cleveland Clinic, two big users of the software from Epic, maybe even at one of those, they don't have enough patients because to do that kind of correlation, to look for that correlation. So at some things, for really rare things, you need a large number of patients and a large data set, sometimes looking back decades. And right. So if you have that, then you can say, aha, it looks like I would have expected 20 people to have it in this population, but we found 200 people. There's something there. Now I could probably get money and or permission to try and say, okay, I see correlation. Is there a causation? How can we figure this out? I think that's the goal.
I'd push back on the Mayo and the Clevelands and stuff. I think what's beautiful about this is that the idea is that it expands it to anybody, not just the big boys in this place. And that was precisely the point about that pediatrician in Flint, Michigan. She wasn't part of some large network, but she went and did the work, which, outstanding example. I love that.
It's
more Flint Michigans to be found, unfortunately, or fortunately, one way, depending on how you see it, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that was, I think, more obvious to her. She was just seeing, this was a rare event and it became a common event for her. And she thought maybe that's just her. Your point's well taken. And that's, I think, when you talk about hundreds of millions of patients, and some of their data kind of really going back a good 20 years in the electronic health record in a discrete way, it's really a treasure trove that's never been available before. So the ability then to also find patients in the future. So now we're going to start looking for new patients. And when they present with X, then we're going to start maybe telling their docs who we've never met on the other side of the world or the other side of the country, hey, this patient might be at risk for this. Click here for more information. I think there's a lot of potential there. It brings to the second, unfortunately, before we get too excited, we go to the second point, which is can you really de-identify patients' data? Because it's small, researchers have shown with a small data set, with a large data set, but a small number of data points, it is possible to re-identify. I'm now at the extent of my brilliance about how to prevent that from happening. I know that there are safeguards in there to minimize the risk of that happening. Oftentimes it happens when you get to very specific pieces of information. So, if there's only 20 patients in a state who have this rare disease and you have their zip codes, you can go back. And if you're working hard and you have access to other data databases, you can re-identify sometimes. I think it's absolutely a risk. I don't think anyone would ever tell you it's impossible that some data will be, some patients might have privacy concerns, reasonable privacy concerns. There may be ways for patients to opt out. again, I think that we're at the beginning of this, and I do not want to say that I'm the expert in how Epic
I think you make the important point here, which is it's reasonableness and, you know, best efforts. I think those are the appropriate words. I think the reality of perfect security or perfect anonymization is just not valid in today's day and age, but we make best efforts. And, you know, the positive value of this, as you've described, actually makes a tremendous amount of sense. So let's extend this a little bit, because I think it's interesting to sort of think about this and say, what are we missing in the vaping story? Because is the data in there, and have we got information in this database to say, what on earth has been going on with vaping, which is now this extraordinary health problem that we're facing? Have we been missing the signals? Is this now an opportunity for us to go diving in, do you think?
You know, certainly, I think it's a valid question. The e-cigarettes, as it was originally, you know, this is what I remember before it was vaping. It was using e-cigarettes, and it was certainly pitched as a safer alternative than tobacco, where we knew what tobacco, we knew what cigarette smoke does to you. And there was no question about that, because it's been for decades and decades. So I think there might be data points there. You know, I don't think anyone knows what's going on with the vaping problem today. Like today, we don't know. We have suspicions, right? The suspicions are that patients, kids, people who were vaping marijuana that they purchased from let's say less than stellar sources, right? So there are some contaminants in there, and that they reacted in a way that was completely predictable once you knew that there were contaminants in there and caused all kinds of problems that we're just now seeing the tips of. So it may be, I mean, that's the theory today. It may change tomorrow. So it may be that while it is completely less horrible than cigarette smoking, yet not safe, if you prepare those little packets in a sterile and uniform way. But certainly if it's some dude in a room somewhere who's got some, you know, watched Breaking Bad and is, you know, creating his own vaping.
The liquid, you mean?
Yeah. Essentially, they're burning. They take marijuana and they have a way of kind of creating that.
Well, I think they put it in petrochemical liquid stuff. I mean, it's, you know, it's no different to sucking in the fumes from your gas tank in some respects.
No question. And so I don't think we know enough to say if there's going to be data points in the electronic health records that we can use to figure out why we see all this epidemic from vaping. It's not really an epidemic of vaping. It's an epidemic of horrible lung disease, which seems to be associated with vaping, more so associated with people vaping substances like marijuana that they didn't buy at the store. So not created under a potentially hygienic situation, and also not created with any oversight from a government or pretty much anyone who knows what they're doing.
So randomly created stuff that's maybe better than the current smoking, but, you know, questionable, and then all the additional consequences. So, I think an interesting opportunity for some of that data. But a central tenet to all of this that we've got in healthcare and healthcare technology is interoperability. I think I've been hearing that word since, you know, I first got involved. We certainly haven't solved the problem. I keep hearing about Apple Health as a methodology. So everybody's throwing everything into Apple Health. Do you think that's going to break the dam? Is that, you know, there's been instances of, you know, the government trying to sort of get involved and create a demand, but I know I'm not interoperable, and I'm as technically proficient as the next guy, but I can't seem to interoperate with anything that I have in terms of my records and the system. Where are we going with all of that?
So just so we set the level, you know, interoperability means I collect information in my healthcare system or in my office, and I want to be able to send it to you or to another doctor in a different state. who potentially uses different software. And the question is, why can't it be as easy as using an ATM? I can take my ATM card, I can go pretty much anywhere in the world, and I can withdraw money, and I can change money from one account to the other. And it's pretty obvious why. And the question I often get from doctors and from patients is, you know, why is this so difficult? And what I always blame it on is anyone but me. So part of it is the way we practice medicine in the United States, I think, or maybe the way we practice medicine everywhere.
Do you think that's solved anywhere else?
I'm not sure it's solved anywhere else. I think it's acutely worse here. And that's with, you know, a couple of days experience outside of the United States. So I don't want to present as an expert in European, the way the healthcare systems work in other places. We really don't like standardization in the United States, right? And we always kind of call it cookbook medicine, meaning, hey, you know, I'm a doctor, there's the art of medicine. I need to make all of these decisions. Don't tell me about these other patients because they're not the patients in front of me. Don't tell me, you know, exactly what I'm supposed to call this thing. And I always get back to, you know, we even in the United States, you know, we call the same thing by three or four different terms. So just to kind of, and I'm not saying that this is the way it should be, but I'm just saying that this is acknowledging the way it is. We can't agree on the list of issues that you're dealing with in your, as a patient. We can't even agree on what we call that, let alone how we would get it from right. One place to another. So, you know, I like to call it a problem list. Some people call it the past medical history. Other people call it other things. And so, A, we can't really, if we can't agree on what those things are, and then, boy, now we have to start talking about how do we get thing A to thing B. So if I write down high blood pressure, is that the same as hypertension? Now, humans are going to make assumptions about that, but the computers are bad at that. I think, right. So I mean, just to kind of explain, why do we have this trouble with interoperability? That's part of the reason. Certainly, there was incentive, financial incentive, for software companies to make it difficult to send information from one place to another, because if you're just using my system, that works, that's great. And I don't want it to be easy for you to use to change to another system. And we can always blame the software vendors. I used to work for a software vendor.
But it's not their exclusive domain, to be clear. It's the system.
Absolutely not.
And so it's an economic argument in so many cases.
So in healthcare, it's in the healthcare system, it's the same, right? I have your information, right. And I'm affiliated with hospitals A and B, and I really don't want to make it easy for hospitals C and D and E to get at your information necessarily, because that tends to make you, I want you to stay and stick with me. I think those are falling by the wayside. So I think the incentive now to do that is much smaller than it used to be. And that part of that's because of the government. I know you asked about Apple Health, and we'll get back to that. The government's, to their credit, is making strides in saying, hey, information blocking, that's their term. Is a bad thing, and we're going to call it out where we see it. Now, I'm not sure that they've really done that yet, but that the risk is there. It was never there before, and so now.
Fairness to them, they've tried. They've just been stymied by, you know, the vested interests and all of the pressures that come to bear when people go, "Oh my God, we can't do that," for fill in the blank of all the reasons.
Are you saying politics might have a play in, you know, good healthcare policy? Because
imagine that.
If you are, I'm shocked. I'm going to have to stop, and I feel faint now. Thank you, Nick. No, you're absolutely right. So there's been lots of reasons for it. Now, what can be done about it? I think many people who do the kind of work that I do in healthcare IT are would love for pretty much anyone to come and say, okay, we're going to be the standard bearers. Right. And when I was on the vendor side, a friend of mine used to say the great thing about standards is there's so many to choose from.
Right.
When you have multiple competing standards, then you have no standards. And so if Apple can come and say, OK, this is how we define issues that the patient's dealing with. This is how we define a lab test and a lab result. These are the code sets that we're going to use and we're going to support. Then that is actually quite helpful, because again, most of us have I prefer you call it this, or I prefer you call it that. But I think you know, just to speak for myself, I don't care. Tell me if someone can come in, whether it's the government or a third party like Apple can come in and say, this is how we're going to define it. And all the others have to just point to us. So that, and we'll be the middleman, so that I can talk from vendor A to vendor B, and Dr. A who calls it this, and Dr. B who wants to call it that. If we can have one party kind of be an official translator, we're going to make tremendous progress. And if that's I'm not sure that Apple is any smarter at this than anyone else, but they do have some cachet, specifically in the U.S. And, you know, more physicians use iPhones than by far [S2] Right. [S1] than any other. So they, you know, we physicians kind of love that Apple. Oh, it's so easy. I wish my electronic health record worked this well. If they can do it, more power to them. I'm not sure they can.
But I don't think that's the important point. What I picked up there that I think is really intriguing about this is it really doesn't matter who it is. It's the fact that there's somebody willing to take it on with enough cachet, deep pockets, whatever. And, you know, in traditional Mythbusters sort of terminology, I'd stamp that as a plausible, which, you know, I have to say I hadn't thought about it in the context of that, but I think that's the right way to think about it. I've been a little bit negative on the large players jumping in because I think the challenge is, you know, oh, healthcare, gosh, we can fix that. We did it here, X, Y, Z. Let's jump in. And, you know, as they all have proven, you know, some more recently, but certainly going back in time, is, you know, you jump in and you go, oh, actually, this is a whole lot more complicated than we thought, so it's not as easy to fix. But I think that the important aspect to this is a willingness that says that's plausible. So that gives me hope. I mean, I'm always, as you know, my glass is full. It's half full of whiskey and half full of air. And I'm looking for the positives. And you've just given me that. So hopefully other people will get that as well, right?
Yeah, I think most of us were expecting the federal government to take the lead. And they haven't really. They've done something with meaningful use and MIPS and other incentives to get doctors to use electronic health records and to communicate amongst ourselves. But if a third party like Apple, heck, you know, the nightmare scenario, of course, is that Google comes and says, oh, we can do this too. And we're going to have slightly different standards, right?
Now we got two standards, yep.
Then it all falls apart. So, right. If Google can come on and do something similar and not and work together, you know, with their arch rivals, then we're really seeing something. But so far, I think it's, you know, Apple's been making the headway, and so good for them.
Yeah. So good news there. So we got a couple of minutes left. Maybe just a quick sort of commentary on Ancestry. They've moved into this genetic testing, but unlike 23andMe, they said we're going to get physicians to prescribe. So we're sort of I don't want to say dodging, that's unfair, but they're moving past the sort of FDA clearance issue that got 23andMe into problems. Where do you think that's going?
I guess just as a physician, when would I, if I'm going to have to make a prescribing decision, you know, I guess I'd have to have criteria. And how would I do that? So that, I think that's one of the big questions is, I'm not going to be treating a disease. If there's no screening recommendation from federal government or from other quality organizations that say this is a good idea, probably no one's going to pay for it. So that means the patient's going to have to pay for it themselves.
Right.
So I'm not really sure that the prescribing would help in any way.
Let me push back just a little bit, and I know we're running out of time, which is always the case. But one of the things that I saw from a Mayo study a while back is that out of 20 patients, 19 of them would show some genetic pre-existing status that actually interacts with one of the top 20 drugs prescribed. So almost 90% plus of us, and I know me personally, I've been screened. I've had a full exome or whatever, biome. I show at least three. I'm not taking any of those drugs, but it's relevant. So just on that alone, if they can provide that, that might be worthy, right?
It might be. That's, again, the problem with science. We don't know that those. You know, so that's all right. Theoretical. Right. There's no proof. And the downside, you got people like me who would never in a million years have one of these studies.
Really?
Done. at this point, just because I'm on the other side of the fence, I'm afraid that that information is going to get into the hands of people who are going to
somebody else.
Use it. The insurance company, or not maybe my insurance company now, but my insurance company 10 years from now, and they're going to go, oh, no.
Thanks, Craig. That's really messing with my head now.
Sorry for being Debbie Downer. I totally understand. I understand the potential benefit, but I'm not sure until there are better laws in place that can be, that the benefits outweigh the risk. It's not obvious, and your decision is no better or worse than mine.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Anyway. We have run out of time. Just remains for me to give a shout out to the CNS Summit that's taking place concurrent with this next week down in Florida. Probably one of the best conferences I go to, really sort of on the bleeding edge of all the sort of activities, cnssummit.org. And remains for me to thank you, Craig. Always a pleasure to catch up. I always learn something, and I end up being both feeling better and feeling worse for my being genetically screened, but the fact that Apple may actually fix healthcare. So thanks for joining me. Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, TheIncrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.